Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. The podcast series you are about to hear befell listeners of a program known as Parallax Views, hosted and produced by J.G. Michael, who the recently arrested John McAfee once speculated was an extraterrestrial Gorgon, devised a series of episodes to be produced and published over the course of a two-week period leading up to Halloween 2020. The result of those recordings led to one of the most bizarre auditory experiences in podcasting history, the Halloween Podcast Massacre. The Parallax Views Halloween Podcast Massacre continues on this edition of the program as we welcome returning guest, Jenny Ashford, the goddess of hellfire, co-host of the 13 O'Clock podcast, and author of the three-volume Unsolved Murders trilogy, The Faceless Villain, to discuss her board and card game endeavor, Giallo Games, inspired by the Italian horror thrillers of the 1960s and 70s. But that's not all. We also talk about some cases from the second and third volume of the Faceless Villain trilogy, including Hitchhiker Murders, the Houston Icebox Killings, the Lady of the Dunes case, and many more on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome back to Parallax Views. One of my earliest guests, the goddess of hellfire, Jenny Ashford. How are you doing, Jenny?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It has been a while since I first had you on the show, and I thought, hey, it's the Halloween season, and what better way to celebrate than to have Jenny Ashford on? For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, maybe you can give a little bit of an introduction to your work, the 13 O'Clock podcast, and just what you've been up to.
Yeah. So I'm pretty much all over the place. I'm a writer and podcaster. I also do some graphic design. But yeah, I have a podcast called 13 O'Clock, which I run with my partner, Tom Ross. We do, we started out doing paranormal stuff and the weird history and stuff, but then slowly kind of got more into true crime because that's kind of more my thing. And I've also written several books. Again, started out doing paranormal books. I did a few poltergeist, a few poltergeist books like True Cases, and then kind of, you know, went off into doing true crime. My latest thing is I did a trilogy called The Faceless Villain, which is the entire 20th century. And there's like, I picked out like really creepy, like unsolved murders, for like the first volume is, you know, the first 50 years of the century. And then I did like 20 years. And, I will probably continue that series at some point, but I had a lot of fun writing that. So I'm kind of going more in a true crime direction, but you know, that's where I'm at right now.
I can dig that. And you're also doing something called Yallo Games. What's that?
Yeah, I started doing, I mean, I've been really into like designing board games for like a really long time, mostly just because I find it fun, because it kind of incorporates writing and design and kind of all the things I like. So I initially started, I was like, you know, I really like Italian, you know, giallo movies, Dario Argento, all that kind of stuff. So I was like, why don't I do like a murder mystery game that has like a giallo look to it, like, because you know those movies have a particular aesthetic and everything. And so I was like, so I started doing, the first one I did was A Crimson Drop on a Crystal Palette, and it's basically, it's sort of like Clue but a little more complicated than that, and there's like all these characters and locations and stuff, and you can solve murders, and the murders are different every time because you can change the cards out like you can in Clue. And then I did another one called The Three Sorrows, which is kind of loosely based on the Three Mothers, you know, that was, you know, prominently featured in Suspiria. And then I also did one.
Initially based on Thomas De Quincey, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Not Confessions of an Opium Eater, but it was kind of like there was an essay called Lavanna and Her Lady of Sorrows, or Our Lady of Sorrows or something.
Yeah, I think it was in a book that was published posthumously, Suspiria de Profundis.
Yeah, there you go. That's what it was. Yeah, Sighs from the Depths, I think, is what it's called. So I decided to do like a witch game, like that you build a castle and like you fight the three mothers. So I did a game like that. And then I did a card game that's kind of like, if anyone's familiar with Shmovie, which is a game where you kind of like have all these cards and you put together like funny movie titles. So I did a game like that, but it was like all giallo themed, like words, and you could like put them together to make a movie title, and then like you had to like pitch the movie to like, you know, whoever else is playing, and they have to like pick whichever one is the best one. So they're all, you know, they're all words like colors and jewels and animals and stuff like that, just like giallo movie titles usually have. So I have that one. And then I started doing like kind of, I've kind of gone out and like started doing different ones. Like I have one called Red Death, which is like an Edgar Allan Poe trivia game where you have to kind of go through all the rooms from Mask of the Red Death and, you know, kind of find your way to the castle. I have one called Boosting Botticelli, which is like an art theft kind of card game. And I have a bunch of other ones that I actually haven't put up for sale yet, but are, you know, uploaded. I did like an Ancient Egypt one. I did like an Absinthe Bar one, and I'm actually working on a Halloween one, and I was hoping that I would have it done for this Halloween, but it just didn't work out.
Halloween is in like Michael Myers, or just like the holiday Halloween?
No, it's in like the holiday. Like it's basically like a story about a Halloween themed town, and there was a horrible murder there, and then 10 years ago, and there's like some demon that's like, I'm gonna kill everybody if you celebrate Halloween anymore, kind of like My Bloody Valentine, I guess, if you know that slasher movie. And but it's kind of like 10 years later, and then like all the daughters of the parent of the people that were murdered, they decide, you know, screw it, we're gonna celebrate Halloween anyway. So it's like they have to go decorate the town and candy and everything, and then they have to like keep from getting killed. So I've been working on that for a long time, and a bunch of other projects intervened, so I didn't quite get it. All the cards are done, the rule book is done. The only thing I need to do, I'm almost done with the board, and I just need to do the board and the box, and then it'll be finished. But I don't think I'm going to have it up by this Halloween, but maybe by next Halloween I'll have everything together and like get it all up there. It's just, I have so many other projects going on that it's like, I kind of work on those for fun, but I don't have as much time to work on them as probably I would like to. But, you know, I've gotten a lot done, you know, more done than I thought that I would, like a lot more games done. So we'll see how it goes. And I definitely want to do some more giallo themed ones too, because I have a really good idea to do one that's kind of a riff on Blood and Black Lace. And I kind of started working on that. Like it's going to be set in like a model house or like a fashion house. And so I kind of have a little bit done on that one too. And that's like another one I'm really excited about. That one's going to take a while because I haven't really worked that much on that one lately.
So I want to hone in on this. I cover like a really broad range of topics, and I usually get into the more horror related stuff around Halloween. And then I cover current events and all kind of other topics the rest of the year. Halloween is a good break period for me. I get to talk about the things I really, really like not having to talk about politics all the time. Oh my God. But for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, because I have some listeners that are like new to all the horror stuff that I introduce them to, what are the giallos? Or I always thought it was yallows, but I guess it's giallos.
Yeah, it's kind of like you can't really say it real hard. It's like, I'm not, you know, I don't know. I don't speak any Italian, really. I tried to learn it a few years ago, but I didn't get very far with it. But from what I can determine, it's giallo. They, you know, they don't say it real hard like that.
Well, I think it translates into English as yellow, right? Because yellow. The covers of the books were yellow. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because the publisher that used to put them out, because it didn't start out as a movie genre. It started out as a literature genre. And essentially what they were was these kind of cheap crime paperbacks. A lot of them were Italian translations of mostly British authors, I think.
So Edgar,
were
like Edgar, what?
Edgar Wallace, yeah.
Yeah, the crimmies of Germany. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because it's the same thing. Like the Germany has the same similar kind of thing. And so a lot of people really liked those. And they, I can't remember the name, it's Montedoro or Monte, it starts with an M. But the publishing house that put out these crime novels had like really lurid, like yellow covers. So crime literature became associated with that color. So then when Mario Bava first started making the movies, everybody just associated, you know, because it was based on that type of thing, you know, they just started calling the movie genre that name as well.
And they're basically, in a way, precursors to the slasher movies of the US.
Oh, definitely. And honestly, I would argue that Mario Bava's Twitch of the Death Nerve.
Bay of Blood
is probably the first modern slasher movie.
You could argue that Friday the 13th ripped it off in a lot of ways, but go on.
Oh, yeah. There's a scene from part two, like with the spear through the couple, like in the bed, that is a direct ripoff of that movie, or homage. Let's not say ripoff, but you know, but it was the first one. Even though it's not a slasher in the sense that there's not like one person going around killing people, but you know, the killer POV thing, like the whole, you know, people getting bumped off one by one while they're having sex or doing drugs or whatever they're not supposed to be doing. So that kind of stuff was very reminiscent of, you know, the later slasher kind of movies. And, you know, a lot of people said Black Christmas too, because that's Canadian. But I mean, Bay of Blood came out in what, 1969, I want to say?
I think it was 71. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, it might have been. I couldn't remember if it was late 60s or early 70s. I might be thinking of like some of his other movies, like I said, like Blood and Black Lace, which I think was 68 or 69. But yeah, so it's definitely a precursor. And you know, people like John Carpenter and stuff like that, you can see in a lot of their movies, you can really see the influence, because he was super into Dario Argento and, you know, some of the stuff. I remember watching Prince of Darkness not too long ago. I hadn't seen it in a long time. And there was a scene in that was just so Dario Argento-esque that I just like couldn't even take it. I was just like, oh my God, he's like, that was such an homage right there.
Mind changed at all since we last talked when it comes to Prince of Darkness? Because you said you're not that big of a fan of it when we talked the first time.
Yeah, I hate to say it. It's like, I love John Carpenter, but a lot of his movies are kind of hit or miss for me. I do like Prince of Darkness and I revisit it every few years, but there's just, and I like the concept of it. I love the concept of it. I don't know, just the execution of it. There's just something that doesn't fall. It just doesn't hit me in the right way, I guess. I'm not sure what. I mean, I don't know. It's just like, and I'm the kind of person that is, I even like John Carpenter's horror anthology. I even like Body Bags better.
Body Bags is great. There's people who dislike Body Bags. He plays the messed up coroner in it. And there's the Toby Hooper, the Toby Hooper thing with Mark Hamill, and there's there's a whole segment where they reference Haddonfield, the gas station killer segment. Yep.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and it's like I feel like when people talk about John Carpenter movies, they don't talk about Body Bags enough. It's like we reviewed it on our show, and so we were like, oh, I didn't even realize John Carpenter made a horror anthology, and I'm like, I think it's on Shudder, or it might be on Tubi for free now that I'm thinking about it, because we just watched it not too long ago. I keep forgetting that he directed Christine also, which I think is also a really underrated movie of his. I mean, I've seen that movie probably 100 times, I think. And I just really, really like it. I especially like Keith Gordon in it. I just think it was a great Stephen King adaptation. And that's another thing. It doesn't really get a lot of props for being a really good Stephen King adaptation, but it really is one of the better ones, I think. You know.
So with the Giallos, and I promise we'll get to the Faceless Villain trilogy, but I want to stick on the Giallos because, like, you know, they're such bizarre films. There's always the motif of the black-gloved killer. The plots usually don't make a lick of sense. The endings usually are like, wait, so that guy was the killer? What is going on with these movies? Right. Well, I think that's what their appeal is, though. They're so bonkers that you have to love them.
I mean, that's definitely why I like them. Because I feel like people that don't like them or they're just like, oh, it doesn't make any sense. I'm like, well, they're not really approaching it from the same. I mean, particularly Dario Argento, he wasn't approaching it from the same thing as like we need like a linear this, that, and the other. It does have a story.
I was gonna say. I always tell people Italian horror movies by people like Fulci or Argento. These are the movies that Italians or they're the nightmares that Italian men have after they have a big bowl of spaghetti and they go to sleep afterwards. And then they have nightmares that make no sense. And then they're like, ah, I will make a movie out of this.
Yeah. They definitely are just all about the set pieces. It's like they don't necessarily, it doesn't have to be logical. It doesn't have to be, you know, like the famous example in Suspiria. It's like, you know, there's not going to be like a room full of barbed wire inexplicably that doesn't like, you know, that has a door that's like off the ground like that and somebody can fall into it. But it's just like Dario was like, you know what? I want to have a girl falling into a whole room full of barbed wire. So let's do that. It's like, it doesn't matter if it makes sense or not. It's just cool. So I kind of like that, you know, sort of just maverick attitude where it's like, well, we just want to put cool stuff in the movie. And it's like, we don't really care if it makes sense in the plot or not. But like I said, they do have plots. They do kind of make sense. Although I've seen some, I think one of the ones that I really dug just because it was so weird was All the Colors of the Dark. And that one is kind of like, that's one of the few that actually kind of has a supernatural element to it. Because a lot of giallo movies don't. A lot of them are not. They're not like police procedurals, but they are like crime stories. You know,
is that
like
one of the ones that has Edwidge Fenech?
Yeah. She was in a lot of those. She was German or Dutch or something, I want to say. But yeah, she was in... Ah, man, she was in another one too. I was thinking maybe it was Short Night of Glass Dolls, but that wasn't her. That was what's her name? Bach or whatever her last name was.
Barbara Bruchette?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. It's like I've seen a bunch Barbara of them, Bach. But it's like I keep, they all have like, there's like a stable of actors kind of from all over Europe that were in a bunch of them. And I kind of forget which guy and which girl was in which movie because I went through a period like probably a year or two ago where I was just like, I'm going to watch all the giallo movies that people say are like the best ones. So I just pretty much sat and like watched all of them like over a couple month period. So some of them kind of blend together. But All the Colors of the Dark, I remember that one sticking out particularly just because it had like these really weird like psychedelic kind of, and I think there was like witchcraft involved or something, which like I said, other than Suspiria, which I don't even know if I would consider a giallo or not, because that's kind of more a supernatural horror movie and doesn't really have the same kind of crime element that a lot of giallos had. But I mean, some of them do have like supernatural stuff in them though. I mean, one of the best ones, one of my favorite giallos actually is Lucio Fulci's The Psychic, which I feel like also doesn't get enough attention. It's just, I think it was called Murder to the Tune of Seven Black Notes also. But I think over here it's called The Psychic. And that kind of had a supernatural element because the woman actually did have like precognitive visions and they kind of like came to pass. And the guy
one that I like is, that's like that, not to interrupt you, but it's like an 80s Argento one called Phenomena. And you're probably noticing a pattern. I like Prince of Darkness. I like Phenomena. Anything with Donald Pleasance, I will watch. the thing is, that also has like this weird supernatural plot where a young Jennifer Connelly has like psychic powers over bugs.
Over bugs, yeah.
But it is giallo. There is like the you know, yeah, mystery killer and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, and from that time period too, like opera is also great. I feel like I love Dario, but I feel like after the last movie of his that I really liked was The Stendhal Syndrome, which was what, 96? Maybe. And I just rewatched it a couple weeks ago and I was like, oh, that's still pretty good.
I have to after be honest, that one kind of disturbs me because I'm thinking to myself, you know, that must be a weird relationship between him and Asia.
I've always thought that as well, because it's like, what must it be like to film a movie where you get brutally raped multiple times and then like cut up by this killer and there's just all kind of this weird stuff going on, and then like having your dad like watching the whole thing. It just must be very, very strange. But you know, I guess it kind of works out, because she was in several of his movies. It wasn't Stendhal Syndrome. What was the other one where she had an eating disorder? Shoot. Now I can't remember.
She's been in so many of those like Italian, yeah, horror movies. I can't even keep them all straight.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And like I said, after the 90s, I kind of like a lot of his movies. Like I really, really hated The Card Player. I really did not like Mother of Tears, which I was really bummed out about, because I was like, oh, he's finally making the third one, like in the Three Mothers trilogy. And then I was like, I would have to rewatch it, though, because I just, or maybe I was in a bad mood, like when I watched it. And I was just
I'm pretty sure Mother of Tears is like universally hated.
I thought it was, too. It's like, but I'm willing. I've only seen it once, so I'm like willing to give it another chance. But I just remember really, really not liking it, because it just wasn't, it didn't seem like it was in the same universe. I think that ship had sailed, you know, it's like he should have made it, you know, a year or two after Inferno, and then it would have all been of a piece, you know, it would have all been together, like it actually went together, because Mother of Tears really just did not seem like it went with the other two at all, and that kind of bummed me out.
There's actually an interesting movie from the 90s called The Black Cat that one, yeah, of his protégés did, Luigi Cozzi.
Yeah.
It's based on the same, like, initial script for Mother of Tears. Okay. It was supposed to be the third one in the trilogy, but, you know, it's not considered a great movie, so people sort of ignore it.
Actually, I don't think I've ever seen that one.
It's known here as Demons 6, Black Cat.
Okay.
And because there's like 5 million Demons movies that, right, have no relation to each other from Italy.
Except for, because only Demons I saw was the one that it was Dario and whoever the other one was. I don't know if Dario produced it, but it was the one in the movie theater with all the...
Yeah, Lamberto Bava. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So that was... I remember that one, and there was a part two, and I think that was all that I saw of that series. I do like those, though.
What, just out of curiosity, what draws you to the giallo movies? Because I guess they're controversial in a sense, even when you watch them now, because you see a movie like Tenebrae, which actually deals with this explicitly. There is, like, a lot of extreme violence towards women, a lot of sexualization, objectification. So what draws you to it as a woman?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not really sure. I don't know if it's the same thing that attracts me to like reading about really horrible true crime too. It might be the same thing. I don't know. The one thing that always struck me about giallo movies, because I love mysteries and I love murder mysteries, and I love the aesthetic of it, especially that's why I like a lot of the ones from the 70s and the 80s, because I like all the clothes and the interiors and stuff. So I just like the way they look, and I like all the lighting and stuff. It's just, I guess because I've been into horror for so long that, I know this is kind of terrible to say, but violence against women is so, you know, endemic of the horror genre, maybe not so much nowadays, but it was, that I'm almost kind of like used to it. It's just kind of like, that's what happens in horror movies.
Well, I don't think it's abnormal either in a way, because, yeah, I mean, when you look at the demographics that are into horror movies, there's actually more women that watch horror movies than men,
which is weird, because that's not how it used to be. Because I remember, I mean, when I was growing up, because I got into horror really, really early, and I really, really liked watching it. I liked, you know, I wrote like scary stories. And, you know, when I was at school, it's like all the other kids just thought I was a weirdo, because it's like, I didn't really know any other girls that were into that, or at least would admit it. You know what I mean? Because some of them would be like, oh, I went to see the scary movie with my boyfriend. And I was like, oh, I couldn't watch it. And I was like, okay, whatever. But you know what I mean? So I was like, giving them some side eye. But I'm glad, that's one thing that I'm glad that has come out like nowadays, that so many more women are into horror and just like unashamedly, you know, that are unashamedly into it. Because it used to be like very weird. It used to be very weird for women to write horror. You know, it was like a standout. And so I think that it's better that we've accepted that. And maybe the thing is that the violence against women, maybe it just like makes it scarier for me, because I'm like, cause you can put yourself in the victim's place easier. Maybe.
I remember I met a woman once at a horror convention. We were chatting about horror movies and we ended up talking about I Spit on Your Grave.
Yeah.
And she said that she found it cathartic. And I was just like really surprised by that. I guess now I can see why.
I did as well. Yeah. I did as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I actually really, really like that movie. I know that it's hard for me to watch. I mean, the rape scene in that is one of the most horrifying things that I ever sat through. But just because the way they shoot it is just like so unglamorized. It's just so realistic. I don't even think there's any music over it or anything. And it just goes on for so long. And it's just like so uncomfortable to watch. But I wrote a big long thing on my blog like a while back where I was kind of like, I don't think that movies like that, I think that that's better. That's how they should show crimes like that. They should show it like it really is, because, you know, if you're glamorizing it or making it, you're minimizing it. I mean, so that's the reason that even though that's uncomfortable for me to watch, you know, that's how it would really happen. And then you're so much more invested when she goes and just like chops them all up at the end. And you're just like, yeah, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's easier for you to relate to her as a victim because all these horrible things happen to her.
I was going to say in that regard too, I really did not like the remake of I Spit on Your Grave, because I felt like the way they would light the rapists in that movie, like, oh, yeah, you know, showing them like under dark lighting and like they make it known that they're like, ooh, the evil dudes. Whereas in the original, like, they just look like normal dudes.
Yeah, it's just like it's daytime, just like in the woods. And it's just like flat lighting. And it's just, that's what I mean. It's like, so I liked that they didn't glamorize it. And I mean, maybe they just did that because they're like, well, we can't do fancy lighting because it's a low budget movie or whatever. But I think it really made it a lot more. It reminded me of like Deliverance in a way, which I think a lot of people don't really associate those two movies. You know, they'd be like, oh, you know, I Spit on Your Grave and it's so like exploitative and stuff. I'm like, it's essentially the same story as Deliverance. You know what I mean? And that movie, like nobody complains about that. But, you know, that's I don't know. I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from with that. But I really actually kind of like the rape revenge genre.
You ever seen Miss 45?
Yeah, I was going to say Miss 45.
I love I did a whole lecture on Abel Ferrara movies when I was in undergrad. And yeah, everyone thought it was weird when I started talking about Miss 45. They were like, what? Why do you watch these movies?
We just reviewed it not too long ago. So actually, I think Tom had never seen it. And I saw it like a bunch of times. So I was like, oh man, you got to see Miss 45. It's like, you know, it's just a great movie. But I don't know if he was into it or not, but you have to kind of be in the right mood, I guess, to watch it. But I love that movie. I like all of Abel Ferrara movies. I think Ms. 45 is probably my favorite, but Driller Killer is good too, you know.
So in regards to the board games, I didn't ask this earlier and it just popped in my head. Were you just sitting down with Tom watching like Suspiria and you said to yourself, this would make a really good board game? Like, how did that come about?
I've been fascinated with, I mean, Suspiria is one of my favorite movies and has been for like a really long time. And when I used to live in Daytona Beach and I owned a house over there, a little one. And the inside of that house, I pretty much painted the entire inside of the house to look like it was inspired by Suspiria. Like I even painted like those Art Nouveau kind of insets, like on the doors and stuff, like on the closet doors and the bathroom door and everything. And I painted all the rooms, like all these really like saturated colors, because I was just so into that. And so I've been thinking about doing a board game that was based around that look for years. And then finally, you know, finally, when I started like looking into, you know, the website, the Game Crafter, where you can just like upload all your files and you can buy little pieces and they'll, you know, box it all up and sell them for you. And I was kind of like, oh man, now is like the opportunity to do that. I didn't want it to be exactly like Suspiria, but I just wanted it to be kind of like inspired by that aesthetic, you know, because that's, it's very gothic, but it's also like really colorful. Like, so it's like black with all these like saturated colors and like all that kind of Baroque sort of furniture and all that like old wallpaper and all that. And I love that kind of stuff. So I just thought that would make a really cool, you know, and then adding it to the whole murder mystery thing just like makes it even better, because who doesn't love murder mystery games? I mean, I certainly do. So that was kind of where that came from. And then I said, I could just do like a whole bunch of games based around different movies, like loosely based around that, and kind of make them all look similar. So that's, I was very excited about it. Those were the first ones I did. Like I said, I've since gone and done like other ones that are, you know, that look a little bit different or play a little bit different. But those were the ones that I was like really excited to get started on.
It's interesting too, because I feel like the one thing that never gets mentioned when it comes to the giallos is actually, I've always made the argument that that whole genre is very influenced by a lot of the women that were around at the time. I'm specifically thinking of Dario Nicolodi.
Yeah.
Argento's wife at the time.
Yeah.
It's like pretty evident based on people I've talked to that she was his muse. And
oh, big time.
You can tell like after they got divorced, you know, his films sort of go downhill.
Yep. I mean, because she was the one, and I kind of feel like I love Dario, but I do feel like he might have kind of minimized her involvement in like how instrumental she was in coming up with, I mean, particularly for Suspiria. I think she might have written the screenplay for that, or at least came up with the idea and came up with a screen treatment for that, that he kind of, because I mean, she has talked about wanting to do something that was like a fairy tale and was about witches and, you know, how she kind of like, she's kind of said at times that she wrote the screenplay and then he says that he wrote it. So I don't know. But like you said, I think that she was a lot more involved in his in writing his movies than he maybe would like to admit, because as soon as they broke up, it's just they just weren't as good anymore. So I think she was definitely like a huge influence.
She's also a huge sweetheart, because I found her on Twitter and I said, I can't read any of your tweets. And she said, I will translate them for you if you ask. I was like, aw.
That's pretty rad.
Hopefully I'll get her on the show at some point. That would be a coup for me, but
yeah, that would be amazing.
I'm curious, moving from the fictional murders of the giallo to the faceless villain, I guess the first question I have to ask is, how did you come up with that perfect title? Because the faceless villain just sums up, oh, unsolved murders. You know, this, that was a brilliant title. Choice on your part.
You know what's weird? I'm totally going to give Tom the credit for this. He just pulled that right out of his butt. We were like, this was many years ago, like before I wrote the first one. And I was thinking, I was like, man, I want to do like a whole, initially it was just going to be one book. But then when I started researching, I was just like, yeah, this is going to be like way more than one book, I'm sure. But so we were talking about it. We were like out walking on the trail. And I was like, I'm going to do this one. And it's always going to have these creepy unsolved murders. And it's like, I need a good name. It's like, I can't really think of a good name. And I was kind of thinking of a few names and I was like, eh, I don't love it, blah, blah, blah. And then he came up with a couple and I was like, I don't really love that either. But then I think he basically just said, how about faceless villain? And I was like, ooh, I was like, that's really good. And I was like, cause he just has these flashes of inspiration sometimes, because his thing is that like I'm sort of like the nerd and I'm like the overthinker, and it's like I always have to be super prepared for everything and have notes for everything and just think about everything too hard. But he's kind of more like the freewheeling type of no filter type of, and he'll just say whatever, and a lot of what he says is like kind of like I'm like, okay, whatever. But then like every now and then he'll come up with like some brilliant like phrase or something. And I'm like, oh man, like I gotta use that. I was like, can I use that? That's like, that's excellent. So that's how it ended up. He just like came up with it one day while we were walking. And I was like, that's it. That's the title right there.
So yeah. For my listeners, this trilogy basically covers a century of unsolved murders. And the first question I have to ask is Iowa. Why Iowa? Why are there so many cold cases in Iowa?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's like, I didn't really know, like, the Midwest in general seemed to have a really lot of unsolved murders. And I don't know if that's because they kept better records, or because the thing about it is that I found like a few databases of crimes from Iowa and Wisconsin and stuff like that, that some other states didn't have. So it might just be that they kept better records of their cold cases than maybe some other places. But I don't know. I feel like the whole Midwest thing, particularly like in the early part of the 20th century, I mean, there was a lot of really horrific crimes. I mean, people talk about the Villisca Axe murders, which was also in Iowa, but there was just like a whole rash of axe murders that happened right around that time, like around 1919, 1920. And there was just, they don't even know if it was the same dude or not. It was just, but it was like dudes probably traveling around on trains and, you know, getting off and just like hacking people up, like hacking up whole families. It happened like lots and lots of times.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because when I went to LA a few years back, I went on one of the Dearly Departed tours where they show you all the crime spots.
Yeah.
And we went to the George Hedel house.
Oh, you know,
and George Hedel, some people say he's the Zodiac, or the Zodiac. Not the Zodiac. Or
he killed the Black Dahlia.
The Black Dahlia.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is I said to the van driver, our tour guide, I said, you know, Hedel's kid, Steve Hedel, claims that his dad was not only the Black Dahlia killer, but he was a Cleveland Torso murderer. He was probably the Zodiac. He was all of this. And he's written it in a book called The Black Dahlia Murder, in case my listeners are lost. Post-production correction. The book is The Black Dahlia Avenger. But I find that completely bonkers. I'm like, I have trouble believing that, you know, there's one serial killer that was going around doing all these murders. But maybe that's the case with the axe murders. Who knows?
Yeah, I kind of feel like the axe murders, I think some of them were probably done by the same person. But the thing about there being so many axe murders during that time period, I think it was just because the axe was a weapon of convenience, particularly in the Midwest, because, you know, if you lived on a farm, you had an axe, or, you know, maybe several of them. And so it was just easy for like somebody that had nefarious purposes to just go in your barn and pick up your axe and then hack everybody up and then just leave. So they didn't have to bring anything to the crime scene. So I'm not sure if maybe it's just because of that, because it was just like a weapon that was easily available, like to somebody that was wandering around. Because, you know, you had the axe man of New Orleans and all these other, the Benny Evangelist murder, which was also like a whole family and somebody came in and just hacked all their heads off with an axe and stuff like that. But it might just be because axes were easily available and you could just pick them up because everybody had them. But I don't know what the deal is with Iowa. I don't know what the deal is, because if people talk about, when they talk about serial killers, you know, talking about California and stuff, we probably did have more, but you know, there was a lot of crimes going on in the Midwest, and particularly in the first half of the 20th century. But yeah, I wanted to say about George Hedel too. The thing about that is that when he gave the case of like, maybe he's killed the Black Dahlia, like I looked at that and I was like, yeah, that's plausible. I don't know. But he did have a little bit of compelling evidence. But then like, I was like, why you want to do that? If you actually thought your dad was a murderer and you actually wanted to see justice done and everything, and everybody like, okay, you know, that could have happened. But then he comes out and he's be like, oh, and he also did this and he also did that. It's like, what? Did he also like shoot Kennedy? Did he also like, you know what I mean? It's like, where does it end? And I was like, that dude must have really, really hated his dad. I'm not saying that I do think George, but you know, whether it was Black Dahlia or not.
You cut out there for a second. You said, I do think.
Oh, I said, I do think George Hedel may have killed somebody. Whether it was the Black Dahlia, there were some suspicions that he might have killed his secretary or his assistant. Even though I think she died of a drug overdose, but there were some suspicions there, but they couldn't prove anything. So I'm not saying he was a good dude. I'm just, you know, even if he did kill the Black Dahlia, I don't think he was the Zodiac. I mean, the Cleveland Torso murder, for heaven's sake, that was like way before that. It's like, what did he start when he was a kid? And he's just going around changing his MO all the time. It's like, oh, now I'm like in Cleveland, like, you know, chopping people up and leaving them in the dump. And then I'm going out to, you know, then I'm going out and killing the Black Dahlia, chopping her in half and just leaving her on the side of the road. And then I'm going to, then I'm just going and shooting people in their cars. It's like, it just doesn't make any sense.
You know, I was going to say, it's interesting you mentioned, like, oh, did he kill JFK too? Which of course, you know, that you're over exaggerating, but it's funny because I didn't realize until I was looking over volume 2 of the Faceless Villain that you have some cases that tie back to Kennedy conspiracy theories, like Mary Pinochet Myers.
Yeah, she was the one that was, she was kind of maybe romantically linked to him.
Maybe did LSD with him, according to some people.
Yeah, that they did drugs a few times and that she maybe like, you know, maybe they were having a little something, something going on. And yeah, she just got killed in the middle of a park in New York City. Like she was out jogging or something like that. And it was noon, I think. It was like the middle of the day and somebody just came along and shot her. And, you know, so they're not really sure who did that. Everybody was like, oh, it was a black man. And we saw him running away from the scene and everything. But I don't know. It just seemed very strange. I think that was right after, it was right around the time of the Warren Commission report was coming out, I think. So some people have thought that maybe there was some, but you know, then again, it seemed like if they wanted to bump her off for whatever reason, it seemed like there would be better ways to do it than just gunning her down in the middle of a public park in the middle of the day when a million things could have gone wrong. I mean, you know what I mean? It just seemed like a really ramshackle operation, if that's what it was, if it was a professional hit. It's like so many things could go wrong. Somebody could see you. There's so many factors in the environment you can't control. And it's like, if they'd really wanted her dead, you'd think they would have done it a lot sneakier than that. So I'm kind of leaning toward maybe it was just a random crime. Like maybe somebody tried to mug her and she fought them and the guy just shot and ran away. But I mean, you know, it's possible she had something to do with JFK, but I don't know. Like I said, it seems like there would be better ways to do it if they wanted to do that.
You know, I wanted to ask you about Lover's Lane murders. I mentioned that in my notes to you. You know, I think people think that's just a thing that you see in the movies, but Lover's Lane murders were like a thing that would happen, you know, in the 20th century.
Oh yeah, big time. I mean, and you know, it wasn't just the Zodiac. Some stuff happened before that. Probably the most famous ones, which maybe a lot of people know, is the Texarkana Moonlight murders, which happened in the 40s.
The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. They made that movie about it, which was not super accurate, but it was, you know, kind of similar.
I love it just because it has that insane kill with the trombone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people think that girl was really killed like that, but she wasn't.
And I mean, it has Dawn Wells from Gilligan's Island in it. So
I know. I haven't seen that. And it was directed by Charles B. Pierce, who made the Boggy Creek.
I actually met Dawn Wells at a convention. And I had bought a bootleg copy of The Town That Dreaded Sundown because it didn't have like a Blu-ray or DVD release. And I got her to sign it. And she's like, is this an official release? And I was like, please just sign it anyways. I love this movie.
Man, I was just watching the Mystery Science Theater treatment of Boggy Creek 2 and The Legend Continues the other day. That's one of my favorite episodes. And Charles B. Pierce is in that. He's kind of like plays the main part, and his son is in it too. And it's a terrible movie, but it's like a really entertaining, terrible movie.
It's funny. The Boggy Creek movies are interesting because anyone can make a Boggy Creek movie now. It's sort of like Amityville because there's no trademark on it. So there's a million different, like there's a Boggy Creek TV series now on Amazon. And it's because, you know, it's easy to make those since there's no copyright on them.
Man, I didn't even know that. Yeah, I guess not. But yeah, that's the thing. Because what you said about Amityville Horror is that that's a real thing that happened, like the murders at least. So that's kind of in the public domain. I guess anybody can make a movie about a real thing, like a real crime that happened or a real urban legend or something. Nobody has the rights to that. It's funny. We were just talking about that the other day because we were doing a show on Ed and Lorraine Warren. It's actually our second one because the first one we did way back episode 38. And that was like our most famous or our most popular episode. Like it got the most views. And also got the most hate mail, like by a very large margin.
Why is that?
But the Ed and Lorraine Warren show. I'm not really sure why people are really, really protective of Ed and Lorraine Warren. And I'm not entirely sure why.
I mean, it's interesting. I think Lorraine comes off as like a true believer, you know, and like a nice old lady. Yeah. But like I look at like Ed Warren and I'm like, they have to be hucksters. Like they're basically scaring people out of their houses. Like,
yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, and I think we said this on the show because I was like, well, she seems nice at least. He never really seemed all that nice. He kind of seemed like a bully, but I mean, I guess they're both dead now. But so we were talking about all the movies that had been based on them, like the Conjuring universe movies. And I guess it never occurred to me, but they're like, the way they're portrayed in those movies is apparently, allegedly, so different from what they were like in real life that there's been like some legal wrangling about, well, you know, can you say that this movie is based on a true story when their portrayal like deviates so wildly from what they were supposedly really like? But I was kind of reading about it and I was like, well, there's really not much they can do because all of the hauntings and stuff like that, that they're making a movie about. I mean, that was supposedly something that really happened. So it's not like you can have, you know, a legal right to talk about or make a movie about something that really happened.
I was going to say in that regard, they could always do what that Vice movie, Lords of Chaos, about the black metal murders in Norway.
Yeah,
they did. They said based on truth and lies.
Yeah. So you cover your ass then. It's like, you know what I mean? And it's like they're always going, well, you know, it's interesting how much like artistic license can you take like when you're talking about people's real lives. But I guess that, you know, any movie that's based on a true story, like most of them kind of, you know, take a lot of liberties. But, you know, it's just really interesting that I just didn't know anybody could make a Boggy Creek movie or anybody could make an Amityville movie. Now that I'm thinking about it. How many of those things are there now? 17, 18. There's a bunch.
They're not even made by the same studios anymore.
Yeah. They're not even made. They're like Amityville Haunting, Amityville Poltergeist, Amityville this, Amityville that. It's like, there are so many. Somebody should do like a podcast where they just sit down and watch every single Amityville movie. I'm sure they probably have nothing to do with each other.
I mean, the thing for me, there's even one with Eric Roberts. It's called Amityville Death House. If you have a movie with Eric Roberts, you know that it's, you know, you've sort of made it into this like cultural phenomena at this point that anyone can be involved in. It's sort of like Slender Man. Anyone can write a Slender Man story. Anyone can make an Amityville horror movie. Although, to be honest with you, I think the only good one in that franchise is Amityville 2. I don't really care for the other ones that much.
I haven't seen Amityville 2. I remember Amityville 2 being pretty good. I haven't seen it since probably the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, I like the first one, but, you know, it scared the crap out of me when I was a little kid, I have to say. It's not scary now, but when I was little, because how old was I when that came out? 7, 8, maybe? And I think I saw it a year or two after it came out in the theaters, and that Jody the Pig scared the crap out of me when I was a kid.
That's the one reason I've always thought that the Lutzes were not telling the truth. When I started hearing about green slime and demonic pigs, I was like, this does not sound like many other hauntings.
And the weird thing, too, is that really the only other one that I've heard of that involves demonic pigs is the Smurl haunting. That was like Janet Smurl. What was her husband's name? I can't remember. But they were on like they did the talk show circuit like back in the 80s. And that was it. They not only had the demonic pigs, but they also both claimed to have been sexually assaulted by the demonic pig. So they one-upped Amityville on that one.
What?
I don't know. The Warrens like worked on that one too. I don't think they've made a movie based on that though. Like,
maybe one day they will. Something. So we've gone a little bit afield of the Lover's Lane murders. Are there any ones that stick out in particular to you?
I mean, other than, like I said, other than the Texarkana Moonlight murders, which I guess a lot of people know about, there was actually one that that was maybe kind of like that was kind of like a similar thing. But this was Larry Payton and Beverly Allen, if people know that one. That's happened in 1960. And these two, basically what happened was, so the two of them, they were both 19. And they had met at work because they, I guess they were students at different colleges. It was Thanksgiving and Beverly had had Thanksgiving with her family. And then she was driving to Portland, Oregon to stay with Larry, her boyfriend. So November 26th, they leave their house at like 9 o'clock. They're going to go do some Christmas shopping or something and they disappear. So then the next day or the next night, actually, November 27th, they find Larry's car and it was in this Lover's Lane and his dead body was in there. He'd been stabbed like 23 times and his skull was fractured. And he also was like covered with mud, like he had been outside of the car, like fighting with somebody. And so they go in the car and he's in there, but Beverly was not in there. Like her body was gone. They found her purse. They found her coat. Her purse had like $11 in it. They found her glasses and, I think part of her fingernail like was in there. And so basically they, after they find Larry's body, they couldn't figure out where Beverly was. So they kind of started looking around. They didn't find her body until January of 1961. So a few months later, and it was 30 miles away and it was just like in this ravine. And she was pretty much naked. I think all she had was like stockings on, but they found all her clothes and stuff. And it looked like she had been raped and probably strangled with a rope. And she died probably pretty much after she was, she was kidnapped. But basically, so this crime has never been solved. They have, they interviewed at the time, like 2,300 people. Only 47 of those were cleared. What ended up happening was that this woman, I think her name was Nikki Essex, and she said, oh, I have information about the crime. So she comes to the police and she said there was this party on that night and there were these three guys. It was like two brothers. It was Carl and Edward Jorgensen. And then another guy named Robert Brom. And it's like, they were going to this party at this house and they ran into like Larry and Beverly, like on the road. And they're like, hey, come to this party. And then there was like a drag race or something. And then Larry apparently like drove one of the cars off the road. There was like a confrontation. And then Nikki said, oh, I ran away. And then I heard a gunshot and all this other stuff. So these three guys were actually, or at least two of them were convicted of the murders. But then it was weird, but there wasn't like a huge amount of evidence against them, like no physical evidence. They were just basically in the area. And this one woman had like said that she heard a gunshot, and after they had had a drag race or whatever. So two of them were convicted, but then like 3 years later, one of them was paroled. And then 7 years later, the other one was paroled. And a lot of people think it was because the authorities were just kind of like we know they didn't do it. So let's let them out. Let's parole them. And we just won't talk about it anymore. So they let them out. And then, so basically now they're kind of like wondering who the hell did this? Because now, the interesting thing about this, though, is that one of the first suspects they had in this case was this dude named Edward Wayne Edwards. And if anybody looks at his Wikipedia page, somebody wrote a book about him like a couple years ago called like, Hi, I'm Edward Edwards or something. I'm the serial killer nobody's heard of, because they think this dude has killed like way more people, like a lot of the Lover's Lane style murders that happened. Because I think there was one that happened in I want to say it was Wisconsin. It was called like the Sweetheart Murders. Kelly Drew or Tim Drew, or I can't remember like what the couple's name was, but there was like a kind of a rash of them like around the Midwest and around like in the Pacific Northwest and stuff. And he was kind of in a lot of those places at the time, but they could never like pin him to any location at that time. Now he was convicted of other things. Cause he was like a robber and stuff. Now somebody did see him apparently lurking around by the Larry Payton and Beverly Allen scene. So he was actually arrested first, but they couldn't find any physical evidence. The weird thing about it though, is that when they picked him up for that, he had like a gunshot wound in his arm. And he said, oh, it was just an accident, or I got in a fight with my girlfriend and she shot me accidentally or something like that. But the weird thing about that was that when they found Larry Payton's car, there was a gunshot that was like going out the windshield, but it was like fired from inside of the car. So I don't know. I feel like Edward Edwards, he's dead now, but he did a lot more crimes than they actually ever busted him for. But I haven't read the book. I've read like portions of the book that somebody wrote about him, but you know, it's kind of a thing where you have all these kind of similar murders and they want to pin everything on one person. And sometimes it is, but it gets to a point, just like when we were talking about George Hodel, where it's just kind of like, okay, one person couldn't have done all that.
Well, not only that, I think it does damage in a lot of ways. Like I know everyone loves the movie Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and it is a great movie. But, you know, when you look at the Lucas Task Force, they just wanted to close a bunch of cold cases.
Yep.
And Henry, you know, being, you know, someone that didn't have the best upbringing, was like, if you give me milkshakes and cheeseburgers, I will confess to these murders. I mean, he said once that he felt like he was treated like a king. He gets to watch TV, then gets taken out by the cops to, fast food restaurants, and they can close cold cases that way. You know, there's still tons of cases that have been pinned on his partner, Otis Toole. And like on the face of it, you know, Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole, they claim to have been part of like a satanic cult called like the Hand of Death. And it involved a huge conspiracy of the police. And I'm like thinking to myself, wow, how could anyone believe this nonsense? But it was a convenient way for a lot of cops to close cases.
And that's something that really, but it's funny because when I was talking about the Edward Wayne Edwards thing, that's exactly who I was thinking of. I was thinking of Henry Lee Lucas because I mean, that guy, he wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, obviously. And he was just, once he got in custody. Now I do think he killed a couple of people, two or three, maybe.
There were claims that he killed upwards of like what, 700 people?
Yeah, like 600 or 700 people.
It's just not even possible.
Yeah, I think even somebody, because somebody did a there was a documentary about him not too long ago. What was it called? The Confession Killer, the Confession something. I can't remember what it was.
Confessions Killer. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And they basically said they figured out, they're like, okay, for him to have done all the stuff that he was supposed to have done, they're like, there is just no way. Because it was just all over the place. And it was just kind of like you said, it's really sad. I understand that cops have a job to do and they have a lot of, you know, murder cases to close. And they always have people kind of barking down their snorkel. It's like, hey, can you solve this murder? Can you solve that murder? And it's like, you know, I get it. But that's really not cool that they would just kind of take it on face value. Just this one person that you're being nice to and you're doing nice things for. Like I said, he gets to run around loose. He gets attention, you know, and he's being treated well. And he's just like, yeah, man, it's like all signed. Yeah, I did that. I did that. I did that. And he probably thought, well, it's win-win. And the cops probably thought that too. They're like, whoop, closed. Look at us. We look like heroes. And that's pretty crappy, I have to say. Not really the best police work. I can understand how it happens, like, you know, but not so good, not so good.
So in regards to some of the other cases you cover, especially in the second two volumes, because when I first had you on, we mainly covered the first volume. The second two volumes, you have some really interesting cases of Jane Doe's or completely unidentified bodies, one of which involves, well, how do I put this? There's a case that may connect to the movie Jaws and Stephen King's son.
Yeah. Lady of the Dunes. The Lady of the Dunes. Yeah, this was an unidentified body. She was found in late July 1974, and this was in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Now, so they find her body. She's like decomposing. The body was found by a poor, sad 9-year-old girl who was just like walking her dog, like on the beach or whatever. And she's like, came across the most horrifying thing ever. So this body had been there for about 2 weeks, I believe. There were footprints, there were tire tracks. So the victim was, she was laying face down. If she was on a beach blanket. And because she didn't look like she'd really fought. So they're not really sure if she just was placed there or if maybe she was asleep and somebody came up and killed her. She had like a blue bandana and a pair of Wrangler jeans, and they were kind of like tucked under her head like she'd been sleeping. So she's this girl. She kind of has long reddish hair. You know, it's pulled back in a ponytail. She's got like this rubber band that has like gold flecks on it. Now, they think this woman, and like I said, she is still unidentified to this day, about 5'6", about 145 pounds. They think she was probably not, she wasn't homeless or anything like that, because she had real expensive dental work, including like a couple of crowns and stuff. They're like probably about $10,000 worth of dental work. But several of her teeth had been busted out. They're not really sure. She was real decomposed. They weren't real sure how old she was. They're like, she could have been anywhere from 20 to 49 years old. She was almost decapitated. And one of her, the side of her head was busted in. Like it looked like a military entrenching tool had done it. And it also looked like she'd been raped, but after she was dead. There was some of her teeth were missing, her hands were missing, and one of her forearms was missing. So they're not sure if animals did that. Well, obviously animals didn't do the teeth, but or if somebody was trying to forestall identification, which I guess worked because they still haven't identified her. So they did DNA, they couldn't find anybody that matched any missing person cases, anything like that. They did DNA, also no match. So basically, this was in 2015, Joe Hill, Stephen King's son, he was watching Jaws and he saw this girl in the background, like an extra, who was wearing a blue bandana and Wrangler jeans and looked very much like the facial reconstruction of the Lady of the Dunes. So he was basically like, maybe that's her, because where they shot Jaws was, you know, would have been right around the time, like before she was murdered. And it was only like 100 miles away. Like, I think it was on Martha's Vineyard somewhere. So I think, I don't know if police are kind of like, cause I've seen the pictures and it does actually really look like her, but it's kind of hard to tell. It's just, it's interesting how she had kind of the same outfit on though. As far as I know, the only real big lead they have is that she might have been seen with Whitey Bulger, you know.
I was going to say, there is some Whitey Bulger connection, some mob. Yeah.
And he was somebody that, because he was a gangster, he was a person that when he killed somebody, he would knock their teeth out. So that was, I think that was why, because those two things kind of like related. And I think also, and I, if I remember correctly, I think the towel that she was found with was very similar to a towel that was at like this club or something like, or like a health spa or something like that, that he was kind of known to go to. So I don't know why he would have killed her. I don't think anyone's ever come forward saying that they knew each other or anything of that nature. But she was apparently seen with him, or somebody that looked like her was seen with him. And also there's a serial killer named Haddon Clark. And he actually confessed to killing her, but also he had schizophrenia. So they're not entirely sure like how much, you know, how much they can trust that confession, because he actually did kind of confess to other things that they know he didn't do. Although he did do a drawing of a body that had like a hand and a forearm missing. So they thought that was kind of interesting that maybe he'd heard about the case elsewhere. But
I always think it's crazy when you have these folks that make fake confessions. Like the big one for me is John Mark Carr, who claimed to have killed JonBenet Ramsey. And everyone thought it was him. Yeah. And then, you know, it just turned out it was a bunch of baloney.
I'm kind of fascinated by, like, in a weird way, I'm fascinated by the psychology of somebody that would do that. I mean, I guess I get it, because it's kind of the same principle as, you know, everybody wants attention. Everybody wants, you know, to be well known, I guess. And if they can't get attention or be well known for something good, then they're like, well, the easiest way is just to say that I did this horrible crime, and then everybody will know who I am and I'll be on TV. And even though everyone will hate them, I don't know. It just seems very strange to me. Like I said, I can almost see why Henry Lee Lucas would do it, just because I think he did kill a couple people and he was kind of a dirt bag. And he's like, well, I'm going to be in prison anyway, so I might as well like make the best of it. So, you know, I'll get all the attention. I'll get treated better than everybody else. So I can almost see why, what his motivation was.
Have you ever
like
seen,
every time, huh?
There's a movie that was made. I think it was before Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. It's called Confessions of a Serial Killer. And it has the special makeup effects guy, I think, or maybe it was the director of photography. In any case, it had one of the crew members from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre playing Henry Lee Lucas. It's real low budget, very bare bones.
Oh, interesting.
But it's actually a more accurate movie than Henry. And they actually make reference to the fact that he makes stuff up. Like at one point, I think it's near the end of the movie, he's like, well, I'll tell you more, but can you buy me a milkshake?
Yeah. Man, he's just he'd sell anything out for a milkshake. Some good milkshakes, I guess.
So in regards to the more gruesome cases, what are some of the more gruesome cases that stick out for you? Because I know everyone loves a good gruesome story. I know that sounds weird to people. It's like, why would anyone be into like really gruesome cases? But people have a macabre curiosity, I guess.
They do. And probably, I mean, there were so many in the book, but one that you mentioned to me that I had kind of, I hadn't forgotten about it, but it was one that I didn't think of initially, was the Icebox Murders, the Houston Icebox Murders. This was like, this is interesting because it's unsolved. They think they're pretty sure, like they know who did it, but they never found the guy because he just basically took off and they don't know where he went to. But this happened in 1965, and this was in Houston. And there's this older couple, Fred and Edwina Rogers. And I guess their family members hadn't heard from them for a while, and they were starting to get worried. So they sent the cops over there for like a welfare check or whatever. So the cops go over there, and they don't see anything unusual at first. But then one of them has the idea to open up the refrigerator. And inside the refrigerator, there was a whole bunch of what looked like very neatly cut meat, like in all these different packages. Now, first they thought it was a hog, but then they happened to glance down to the vegetable crisper at the bottom, and there was two severed heads in there. So, which obviously were Fred and Edwina Rogers. Now, they're pretty sure that this couple's son, Charles, killed his parents. Because, I mean, he didn't cut them up alive. I think one of them was shot. And then I think the other one was bludgeoned. Charles was 43 at the time. I think he was like some kind of high up. Did he work for NASA or he was some kind of, he was like a rocket scientist or something like that. But he had lived with his parents and he was real weird. Like he was real reclusive. Like he wouldn't go out during the day. Like he would only talk to them by like writing notes and like sliding it under the door. Like, so that's how he communicated with them because he wouldn't talk to them, I guess. So after, I mean, and he disappeared like as soon as they found these chopped up bodies, and they never did find the dude. They don't know if he like changed his name. He took off. Like some people said, oh, he went to Panama and got like killed by a drug dealer or something like that, but they never found him. And the weird thing too, is that later on it came out that it's possible that he killed his parents because they had been stealing money from him. Like, I guess that the house that they lived in was his, and they were just living in it. And they were like, you know, taking all this money from him. And I guess he just snapped and he couldn't take it anymore. Now, I don't know why he didn't just shoot them and leave them. I don't know why he felt the need to cut their bodies up and wrap them all nicely and then put the heads in the refrigerator. Like, why would you go to all that trouble? it just seems like much easier to just shoot him and, I don't know, bury him in the backyard or I don't know. It just seems a very strange thing to do.
I mean, but it seems like something out of like a B horror movie.
It does. And I mean, that guy, he just seemed like a really weird dude. And that's I don't know. It's killing your parents. I mean, like I said, if that was true, if the parents were stealing all his money and they'd been doing it all this time and they were abusive and all this other stuff, like I get it. But to me, it just seems like, I mean, and that's the reason that they knew that he was probably the one that did it, because he had cleaned up the house pretty good after chopping up his parents, allegedly. But they found a little bit of blood on the keyhole of his bedroom door. So they figured that he must have probably been the one that did it. So it just seemed like so much trouble, so messy, and so unnecessary. If he had plans to just, you know, skip town, like get out of the country. And apparently he had plans because they never found him. So I don't know why he would risk getting caught, like going through all of that rigmarole when he could have just killed them.
The other one that stood out to me was the, the Taddington or Taddingstone suitcase murder?
Yeah.
The guy's body is cut up into little pieces
and put stuffed in a suitcase. Yeah. That was in the 60s. That was in 67. And, this seems very strange because this was a guy who was just, I guess he was just going out to a pub or whatever with his friends. And on his way home, he apparently got waylaid by somebody. And they didn't know where he was. Like his dad, reported him missing. But then 10 days later, this farmer finds these two suitcases like underneath a bush or something. And he opened them and there was a body in the two of them, like cut into 8 pieces. And the dude had been raped and strangled and then cut up and then put in these suitcases and then just like left under a hedge someplace. And it was creepy because they didn't know who he was because he didn't have any identification. So they took a picture of the severed head and put it like on the front page of the newspaper. And Bernard Oliver was the name of the guy. His 15-year-old brother, Chris, saw the front page of the newspaper, like at a bus station, and he recognized, he's like, oh my God, that severed head is my brother. And that's how they found out who it was. So it's like, and they still don't know. The weird thing about this one too, is that most of the main suspects in this case were like medical doctors, but they were also doctors that were, later indicted for various other things, usually like child pornography or like, you know, sexual assault of minors and things. Like a couple of the doctors and a couple of them were associated. And then like after Bernard Oliver got killed or after they found his body, like the one of them, like, because this was in the UK, like one of them took off to Australia. The other one went to South Africa and then to Australia. And then they got in trouble over there for, you know, allegedly like raping some little boys or something. So I think this might have been part of a small pedophile ring, because there was kind of a small pedophile ring based in that area, like around this one particular church in near Taddingstone. And they think that these two doctors, and there was a couple other ones too, that were kind of involved in that. And so they were kind of suspected in a bunch of different rapes and murders, but they never had enough like physical evidence to bust them with it. It's like some people were like, one of the doctors, they were like, well, somebody had seen him with a suitcase that had that, because it had like a little thing that said PVA on it, like a little, like a brass thing with initials. And somebody said that they'd seen him carrying that. But that was it. That's all they had, was like a witness thing. They never had any physical evidence. And I don't think they ever like even convicted any of those guys for anything. And they eventually came back to the UK and they just kind of, No one ever did anything about it. But yeah, that was kind of, there was a few cases too, like in the earlier, I can't remember offhand, but there was a couple that happened in the UK. It was kind of a thing for people to kill people and then put them in a trunk. And then the trunk would be like at the train station, they would like abandon it in the train station. So then it would be like in the lost and found thing, and then later it would start smelling funny in there and people would open it and there'd be like body parts in there. There was kind of a, not a rash necessarily, but there were a whole bunch that happened. It was like the Brighton trunk crime and a couple other ones. That was like early 20th century.
Some of the United Kingdom ones are like either really weird or just really gory. You know, the Pink Sox one, Fred the Head, sort of threw a curveball for me.
Yeah, because that poor guy was just, he was also raped and murdered and they just found him. He was like all, they found him. He was real decomposed. So they still don't know who he is. They call him Pink Socks because that's all he was wearing was like these little pink socks. And I think he had like a lady's wedding ring and he was just found in a hole, like kneeling and like kind of tied up. And that's another one that they never identified. Same thing with the nude in the nettles. That was kind of a woman that they found just under this bush that had been there for a couple of years. They thought maybe Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, that maybe that was one of his early victims, because that was somewhere that he, where the nude in the nettles was found, that was somewhere where he would have, because he was a truck driver, that was somewhere where it would have been on his route, like at around that time period. But he usually, and this is horrible, but one of his things was he would bash in women's heads with hammers, and this woman apparently didn't have that, although they haven't released the cause of death on that one as far as I know. But they did say that, well, she wasn't bashed in the head with a hammer. But that doesn't mean that Peter Sutcliffe didn't do it. Maybe that was just like one of his early crimes where he hadn't got into doing that yet. You know, because they do change their modus operandi sometimes.
So before we wrap up, I just had a few more things I wanted to cover. I guess this is good because, you know, when you think of horror movies, you think of the hitchhikers getting knocked off. I did not know about some of these hitchhiker murder cases, even ones that I assume are more well-known. I had never heard of the Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders.
Yeah, there are so many. I mean, like not so much nowadays because people don't really hitchhike anymore. But for a time there in the 60s and 70s, when hitchhiking was like no big thing, it seemed like it happened a lot. And it happened in the 80s and 90s too. You had like Texas killing fields and stuff like that where, you know, stuff happened along a highway and they kind of suspect that a lot of the killers might be truck drivers. But Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders, they're not sure if all of them were done by the same person, but this is like at least seven people. This was 1972, 1973, and pretty much around the North Bay area of California. And these were like younger girls. I mean, like the first victims that are like canonical in the Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders were 12 years old. And they were basically hitchhiking, like a way they'd been at like an ice rink or something. And they were hitchhiking. And then they found their bodies like a while later. And they were skeletons by that time. So they didn't really know what the cause of death was. And then the next victim was Kim Allen. She was 19. And she was just hitchhiking from work. They found her later on. She had been tied up and she'd been raped and strangled with a cord. And then there was Lori Lee Cursa, who was 13. And she actually ran away. She was at a store with her mom, like at a U-Save. And she just decided she was going to bug out for whatever reason. And so she was going to hitchhike to a friend's house. But she disappeared. And then they found her later. She was frozen, basically. Like, they found her down an embankment. And hers, I'm not real sure, like, because they're like, well, it was probably a murder because it looked like the murderer had thrown her off the embankment. But she died of a broken neck. So it could just be, and she wasn't raped as far as I know. So it might just be that might have been a different thing.
So is it almost like the whole... I mean, everyone talks about the Gilgo Beach killer, where, you know, some people say, oh, whoever did this murder at Gilgo Beach. And really, you know, it's not as simple as that.
It really isn't. And like I said, it's horrifying because when you look into like all these hitchhiker murders, all these ones that happen along highways in particular, I think a lot of those are just, I don't think that's all one person. I think there's a whole bunch of guys that are just serial killers, and that's how they evade detection. It's just either they're truck drivers, or they, you know, or they drive around a lot for work, and it's just like crimes of opportunity. It's like they see some girl at a rest stop, they see, you know, maybe there's a sex worker like at a truck stop or whatever, and they're just like, hey, I'm gonna kill this one. And then if they pick them up and kill them and dump them like two or three states away, you know, and they don't have any ID or anything like that, it's like that's not gonna get, you know, that's not going to come back to them. Nowadays it might, because, you know, of DNA, but I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, when everyone was hitchhiking, you could pretty much do that with impunity. You could just like drive around and pick a girl up and kill her, and then like two or three states later just dump her on the side of the road somewhere. And,
unless,
like,
you picked up Aileen Wuornos, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We still have it. We really need to do a show about her. Because, I mean, I'm from Daytona Beach, and that's, you know, she spent a lot of time there. And I remember, and I lived there like when her crime spree was going on. So I'm actually like shocked that we haven't done a show about her on 13 O'Clock. We need to do more female serial killers. I know there's not as many of those.
A lot of them are Angel of Mercy killers, right?
Yeah, we did do a show about Angels of Mercy killers. But I had a couple, you know, women and a couple dudes on that one. And we did like Harold Shipman and a couple of the other ones. It does really seem like, I mean, women, there are female serial killers, but they have different motivations, and their motivations are mainly practical, not so much sexual.
Like, can you explain?
I kind of feel like women serial killers in the main, it seems like they're killing for either psychological reasons, because like Munchausen by proxy, you know, like they're killing children, or like you said, Angels of Mercy type killers, or it's purely a financial gain. Like somebody like Belle Gunness, who was basically just, you know, she would lure dudes to her farm. It's like, hey, I'm like a, you know, I'm a widow and I have a big farm and money and stuff. And the guys would come there with their money. She would take their money and she would like knock them in the head and like bury them in the pig farm. You know what I mean? So I do feel like they have a motive, like a more practical motivation. It's like just to get money or to get somebody out of the way or something like that, where I feel like a lot of male serial killers are more sexually motivated. Not always, but like somebody like H.H. Holmes, I think that was mostly financial. But, you know, most of those serial killers, people talk like Ted Bundy and, you know, the Green River Killer and people like that.
Bundy's been accused of that Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders as being one
of
those.
He has, yeah.
I think Zodiac was, Hillsider Stranglers were.
Yeah. Yep. They definitely were. But yeah, so that's what I mean. It's like, I can see why you'd want to do that, because it's like, you don't want to think that there's like hundreds, thousands of people running around doing these types of crimes. So it's like when you have a bunch of them, like kind of in the same area, kind of the same MO, it's like, well, hopefully that's the same person, because otherwise there's six dudes running around doing this stuff. And that's really scary. But honestly, it's a big country. There's a lot of people live here, and, you know, a few hundred serial killers, it's not really that far fetched to think.
And a lot of murder cases go unsolved.
They do.
Yeah.
It's weird, because I would have thought, I mean, with the advent of DNA, with the advent of better forensic technology, I would have thought that we would have less unsolved murders nowadays, but that does not appear to be the case. Now, I'm not sure if that's because cases back in the old days were solved by, oh, hey, somebody confessed and we put them in prison, therefore it's solved. You know what I mean? So maybe that wasn't even the right person that did it. So it could just be that. It could be that, you know, yes, they put somebody in jail, but that wasn't necessarily the right person because they didn't have, you know, the physical evidence like we would have nowadays. But I was really actually kind of alarmed. I can't remember exactly what the statistic is, but I was just looking that after a certain time period, like nowadays, I think only about 50 to 60% of murders are solved. You know, meaning, I'm not sure if that means like, I'm sure that means like conviction. But that's not good. I mean, but the thing about it is that, as I said, if it's somebody that is, you know, just driving around and killing random people, that's going to be very difficult to solve. And also, I think a lot of murders too are like, you know, gang related things like that. So you're not really going to get, you know, the same kind of witness participation because people are afraid. And it's like, so I think a lot of those go unsolved. When I was researching some more recent unsolved murders, the vast majority of them were kind of like, were gang related or drug related. And there are just so many of them because, you know, this people that live in that neighborhood are like, well, we're not going to cooperate like with the police because it's like, then we'll get in trouble with, you know, or we'll get shot. So it's like, they don't want to do it. So I can see how it happens in that sense. But, you know, on the other hand, with all the stuff they're doing with the genealogy websites and everything, they finally caught the original Night Stalker, Golden State Killer, which I never thought they would do. I mean, we did a show about him before he was caught and we were talking about him. And then like, what was like a year later or something like that. And they caught him. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. I never thought they would catch that guy. And I keep hoping that they'll still find out who the Zodiac was, because that is killing me, that I really, really need to know who that was.
You don't think it was, who's the main suspect that everyone talks about? Arthur Lee Allen.
Arthur Lee Allen. I think he's the most likely suspect. Yeah. But I'd like to know for sure, you know. I do probably think it's him, because I know like everybody's pulled out. Some people have even said the guy I mentioned earlier, Edward Wayne Edwards. Somebody said, oh, maybe he's the Zodiac. And I was like, I don't know. I do think that he did some murders like that, but I don't think that he was the Zodiac. So I think Arthur Lee Allen is probably the most likely suspect.
You're reminding me, I have to watch. Have you ever seen that Masters of Horror episode, Pick Me Up?
Yeah.
With I'm thinking about that this whole time now, because it's I want to see that, like serial killer versus serial killer. Yeah, for people that don't know, it's about a truck driver who murders women, and then the hitchhiker also murders women. He picks up the hitchhiker. It's like killer versus killer. But you know, there probably are so many unsolved cases that, you know, killers like that exist that we just don't even know about.
Oh, I'm sure. And, you know, like I said, I was actually kind of scared when we did the show about the Gilgo Beach killer, because I'm like, that dude's probably running around still somewhere. And it's like, I don't know if we should do a show about that or not. It's like better to do ones about cases that, you know, most of the suspects would be like 80 years old now. So it's like, even if they did want to come after me, they'd be like too old to do anything bad. But, you know, it's, and the thing too, is that I'm thinking about doing, well, actually I kind of started it, but I'm thinking about doing a Faceless Villain 4. I might do another trilogy, or it might be 4 books. I'm not real sure. I thought what I might do was, instead of doing like unsolved murders, like 20 years, I thought that I might do like 5 years at a time and then cover cases, unsolved murders from those 5 years. And then cases that were solved, like from that I had wrote about before, like, because some cases have been solved subsequently, and put that in there. And I might put disappearances in there too, but I'm not real sure. I'm still kind of like, I've written a couple chapters, but I'm still kind of wondering what I'm going to do about it.
That's the last thing I wanted to get into, was unsolved disappearances. We need you, Jenny, to do a book on unsolved disappearances, because if I hear another thing about that missing 411 book and how Bigfoot is killing people in the woods, and and then the smiley face murders. Well, there's a group drowning people in the UK and the US. Yeah. And like, oh my God. It's like these unsolved disappearances now are turning into like huge conspiracy theories. I just saw someone on Twitter the other day was trying to say that Tara Calico, who is probably one of the most famous unsolved missing girl cases. Someone was trying to say it's connected to like this Pizzagate, like QAnon conspiracy theory. Oh God, Jesus. They even connected that. So we need someone that will actually cover the cases and not sensationalize it and claim that it was Bigfoot or smiley face murders or satanic evil pedophile elites or whatever the fucking conspiracy nuts think.
It's sad because I know people love that. I know people, you know, are really into conspiracy and stuff. And I'm not saying that conspiracies don't exist, but my metric is the larger a conspiracy is supposed to be, like, the less likely it is to be true.
Hear the one that the Yorkshire Ripper was really actually Jimmy Savile?
Yes, I have heard that one. I mean, some of the stuff is just so obviously not that. You know what I mean? And it's just kind of like, if you thought about it for 5 minutes or you did like 5 minutes of research, you'd be like, yeah, that's not, it's like, you know, the guy was dead or the guy was, it just seems like, I know why it is. I know, particularly when you're talking about murders and disappearances and stuff, you don't want to think that, you know, as in the case of like the smiley face murders, or in the case of like the pusher, like in Manchester, the UK, that people are falling in the canals or people are being pushed in the canals and, you know, someone's drowning them. It's like, I don't think people like just, you know, someone just falling in, or some people just disappear. Like some people are like, oh, they just went hiking in the woods and somebody just killed them. Or, you know, there was an accident and they died somewhere and nobody found their body. I think that's very, unsatisfying for people. And I also think that people really like to tell stories. They like to make connections. And I don't think people like when random things happen, like especially to like a good person. They're like, well, they can't have just like died for no reason. Like there had to be some kind of story behind it. There had to be some kind of conspiracy behind it, but there's not always. I mean, everything's not connected in that way. Sometimes bad things just happen and that sucks, but you can't just make everything have this big greater meaning, because sometimes it really doesn't. And I mean,
the one that gets me is like, there's a whole theory that I don't understand the theory completely, but that the Zodiac killer was like sort of a hoax, that there was multiple killings and they had to do with gangs or something. Do you know what I'm talking
about?
Yeah,
there was, yeah, wasn't that was, or no, that was the Son of Sam that I was thinking of, that there was more than one of them. I don't think I've heard the one about the Zodiac. I've heard the one that Son of Sam wasn't David Berkowitz, or wasn't just David Berkowitz.
Yeah, that supposedly it was this Jesus freak cult called the Process Church of the Final Judgment.
Yeah, there you go. That's what it was. But yeah, it's like, you know, it's just kind of like, you know, as I said earlier, like, you know, we got so much hate mail for our show about the Warrens. I think the second video that we got the most hate mail on was about the smiley face murders, because people are really invested in the idea of there being a group of serial killers that meet on the dark web or whatever, that go around just drowning people and then drawing smiley faces on walls. And it just seems
why are they doing this? What's the MO?
That's what I mean. It's like that if you're going to be a serial killer, I mean, you know, I don't advise it, obviously, but if you're going to be a serial killer, like drowning people seems like the dumbest possible way to be a serial killer. I mean, and it just seems like so many. Now, at least one of those crimes, I can't remember what the victim's name was, but at least one of those crimes, I think, was a murder, just because the way his body was found. But that was the only one that I could think of that, oh yeah, that guy probably got murdered. Maybe he was, you know, got in a fight with a guy and the guy like killed him and then took off or whatever. But every single one of them, it seems like most of them were just accidents. And when we talked about, because we did a show about smiley face and then we did a show about the pusher in the UK. And I feel like what's happening there is that Manchester has all of these canals and they don't have adequate railings around some of the places, and that's where all the pubs are. I said, so dudes are going out, they're getting drunk, they're trying to pee in the canal and they're falling in and then they can't get out. I said, I think that's pretty much all that's happening. I don't think anyone is killing those dudes. Like I said, it seems like the world's most inefficient way to kill people is by pushing them in a canal and then drowning them or hoping they'll drown. It's, why would you do that if you're a serial killer? It just seems really, really dumb. But like I said, people like patterns. They like stories. And
well, sometimes I think people just, I think some things are too hard for people to believe. Like, I don't know if you ever looked at the Jeffrey McDonald and the murder of his family, where people will say to this day, they're like, oh, it was the satanic hippies, because McDonald was, I guess, a military guy that said, oh yeah, these hippies came in and said, acid is groovy, kill the pigs. And then they killed my family. But it's pretty obvious that that's bullshit and that he did it. People like Earl Morris and the Innocence Project have like protected him for years, or claimed his innocence, I should say. And I'm like, the acid is groovy, kill the pigs things, that seems like too much out of a fucking movie for me to believe that.
Yeah,
but I think, like, some people don't want to believe a military guy would family annihilate.
Which is crazy, because that, I mean, A lot of people did it. In fact, we were just watching, we just reviewed that Netflix documentary about Chris Watts, you know, who was a family annihilator. He killed his two little girls and he killed his pregnant wife. And we were just talking about that guy. And that guy seemed like the blandest, most normal, upper middle class dude, just had a normal job, normal house, like nice house, lived in a nice neighborhood. Everyone just thought he was super cool. No red flags at all. And he just decided he had a mistress and he's like, oh, it'll be a good idea to kill my whole entire family.
And, you know, I'm doing a show with Jake Anderson, who just wrote a book, Gone by Midnight, a while back. Yeah. Elisa Lam, do you have a take on that? Because he thinks it was murder. He thinks it was like a sexual predator of some sort. I know most people seem to be in agreement that, you know, she just had mental health issues.
Yeah, I kind of feel like we did a show about that a while back and I was like, yeah, there's a slight possibility it could have been a murder. There was a couple things that were kind of strange that I thought, like, because when there's like some kind of gravel like found in her clothes or something. And I was like, that seemed a little weird. But I think that she probably just had mental issues or had some kind of psychotic break or something like that and climbed up there for some reason.
But people that don't know, she ended up in, I guess, the water tank of the
hotel.
A hotel that is known for being scandal ridden. I think it was the basis for the American Horror Story Hotel season.
Yeah, but I think
people were drinking the water the next day. They were like, oh my God, it tastes horrible. And then they found her body.
And then they
found
her.
That's why the water was like that. Ooh.
And probably everyone in that hotel was just barfing forever, because I certainly would if I found that out.
So,
by the way, I know you've been drinking this water for 4 days, but we just found a dead body in there. Yuck.
So we weren't able to get to some of the multiple homicides. We'll do that another time. I want to pick your brain about the alphabet murders at some point. But what are some cases that you're looking into now? And are there any unsolved disappearances that really like took you?
I remember, gosh, because we've done a couple episodes. I think we've done 3 episodes of like creepy disappearances. What was the one? I can't remember his name like offhand right now, but it was the guy that basically they have camera footage of him going into this bar or restaurant, like with some friends. And then at some point they lost track of him. And then he just disappeared and they don't have any footage of him coming out at any point. So, but they've searched through all the restaurant and everything and they're not really, so they don't really know where he would have gone to. So that one kind of creeps me out. I can't remember what his name, I want to say it was Brian something, or I can't really remember offhand.
But yeah, I like the one you did on Tara Calico, because I didn't realize, you know, for people that don't know, there's these Polaroids that came out of her and some, well, allegedly her and some other unidentified boy tied up and whatnot. And I always thought, because I had seen so many pictures of it in the national news, oh, that's definitely that they confirmed that that was Tara Calico. But apparently that's not the case.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Oh, my cat's going to crawl over. No, no, no. She wants to crawl over the, she wants to crawl over the keyboard. No, please don't. Please don't. Don't be bad. Yeah. But yeah, she, that was, and the weird thing about that was, hey, oh man. The weird thing about that was that the Polaroids were found in like a parking lot or something, right? It was like, weren't they found, like there was a van parked there and then the van left and then there were these Polaroids left. It's like, is a really, and I don't think anyone's ever determined, I don't think they've ever definitively determined if that was her or not. It looks like her, but
it's a creepy photo either way.
It is.
Although Tom seemed like he thought, oh, it's just kids having fun. It wasn't really a murder.
I don't know. It seems like a pretty weird photo to take, though. I mean,
that's what I was saying when I was listening to you guys. I was like, does Tom really believe that?
Yeah. It's, yeah, it doesn't really seem like the kind of picture you would take if you were just like hanging out, having a good time. It just really doesn't look like, it's very unsavory looking. I don't know. But yeah, I don't, yeah, we probably need to do more. And I can't remember, I'm sorry, I can't remember this other dude's name, but he was a guy that disappeared. I guess they had him, he had called from his truck and it was like the middle of the night. He wasn't drunk or anything like that. But then I guess he started yelling and somebody heard like gunshots in the distance. And then he just disappeared somewhere. Like he had been talking to his family. And I think he said that he was lost, even though he was somewhere where he should have known where he was. You know what I mean? So I don't know if he had some kind of, that's a pretty messed up one. And like I said, I can't remember his name.
You cut out for a second there. You said some kind of.
I don't remember what I said.
Fair enough. I'm keeping that in there. That's one of those funny moments. It's for the blooper reel. Are there any other cases that you are working on for any future books?
Basically, I've gotten, like I said, I have so many other projects that I've kind of like, I wrote a chapter on some unsolved murders that happened in 2000 and some that happened in 2001. I'm kind of talking about the one case that happened in the UK with he was kind of like a famous like TV presenter, and this dude was found dead in his pool that they tried to make it seem like an accident, but some people suspected that the guy was raped and murdered. So I'm doing that one. But yeah, there's a lot of unsolved, and honestly, I'm really having a hard time with this one because, you know, the records are a lot more recent. So there's a lot more of it online, much easier to do research. And so I'm really having to like wade through so many cases, and I'm having a hard time like deciding which ones to put in the book and which ones to leave out. Cause there's so many that I'm just like, I can't put these all in here, especially if there's not like a huge amount of information about them. Because like I said, there's a lot of like kind of gang related murders and stuff where basically all they know is like, well, this guy's just got shot at this intersection and nobody saw anything. So it's like, we don't really know. And I was like, well, I don't really want to put all those in the book because it's not, you know, it's sad, but there's nothing like there's nothing to go on. There's nothing to like talk about. So I'm trying to keep it to ones that are strange or that there's a lot of information about it, or it might be linked to other ones. So we'll see how it goes. Like I said, I think I might do it in 5-year increments instead of, because I think the first trilogy I did 50 years, the first 50 years, and then
and this will be the 21st century, right? The new trilogy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I might call it, I don't know. I might call it Faceless Villain Millennium or something like that. I'm not really sure what I'm going to call it yet, but I think it might be end up being 4 books, but we'll see how it goes. And like I said, I might put creepy disappearances in there, and I might put updates to cases that I've talked about before that have subsequently been solved, because a few have. So I'm thinking about doing that and then maybe working on that like next year after I get all my other stuff done, you know.
Have you come across, in terms of 21st century cases, have you ever come across the death of Jeremiah Duggan?
I don't think so. That doesn't sound real familiar.
You should look that one up, because I interviewed his mother, and it's a case in Germany that also involves British authorities because they wanted to investigate it. But Jeremiah Duggan was like this anti-war activist that got tied up in the LaRouche movement, which is really weird political cult. And he called his mom and he said, I'm in a lot of trouble. And this is when things between him and the LaRouche people he had been recruited by were getting bad. And then he's found dead, I think, the next day. And it's one of the weirdest cases. That's a case where I think there was a conspiracy.
Yeah. Sometimes there are. You know what I mean? Just most of the time, probably not. But yeah, that one definitely sounds like there's some shenanigans going on there.
So how can my listeners keep up with your work and the 13 o'clock podcast?
13 o'clock is probably I have like an audio version that I put like on iTunes and all that. But honestly, if you want the full experience, you really have to watch it on YouTube, because a lot of our shows we live stream, and you know, you really need to see the visuals because we make all kinds of like faces and Tom does all kind of crazy stuff on there. So you just go on YouTube and it's just called 13 o'clock podcast. We have tons and tons of shows. We do paranormal stuff, true crime stuff. We do movie reviews. I do book reviews. I read like classic horror stories. So we have all kinds of different stuff, like all spooky stuff on there. And I just have a website that is just www.jennyashford.com. That's got links to all my books and links to the podcast and links to the games and links to everything else that I work on. So that's probably the easiest. That's like the hub of all my stuff. So that's the easiest way to get to it.
Well, thank you again, Jenny Ashford, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you very much for having me. I had a great time.
Well, that does it for this edition of the Parallax Views Halloween Podcast Massacre. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jenny Ashford. Please be sure to check out not only her three-volume trilogy, The Faceless Villain, but also her podcast, co-hosted with Tom Ross, 13 O'Clock. If you enjoy the Halloween editions of Parallax Views, well, 13 O'Clock does it year-round, and I think you'll enjoy it. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Emilia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Zach, Gratz, Ted, Mickey, and Chase. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tier of my Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Your support is very much appreciated. And with that being said, Yeah.